how does Christianity play into sexuality? I would have to say, of all the things that people your age have to contend with so far as being a Christian is concerned, nothing is more important than sexuality. People talk about peer group. Peer group pressure, I could always handle. I don't know about you. I never had any real... Secondly, I got to tell you that peer group stuff tends to be overdone. You know, everybody says, oh, the terrific pressures of... I remember when I became a Christian. Now, maybe it's different in Australia, but it was in a Youth for Christ... You know, you have Youth for Christ over here. It was a Youth for Christ gathering, and they said, now, when you go back to school, they will persecute you. If you're... So, you know, gee, that's... And remember, you must be strong. So, the next day, after becoming a Christian, I got this big Bible, see, and put it on my books because they said I ought to carry my Bible because that would be a great witness. So I went into school, you know, I sat down with the books and the Bible, and I waited for the persecution to start. And the Jewish kid next to me, Jerry Horowitz, said, hey, Tony, what's that? My Bible, Jerry. It's my Bible. I made a decision last night. Gave my life to Jesus. And from now on, I'm going to live according to the teachings of the Bible. And I waited for the laughter, for the spit, for the stones, for the accusations. I just wanted something like that to happen. Because I knew that verse that said, blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you and say all manner of evil against you. I was waiting for the reviling to begin so that I could consider myself blessed. And he said, hey, that's really great. We need more people like you. That wasn't what he was supposed to say. He turned to the kid next to him and he said, hey, Charlie, Camp Paulo's really on this religious thing. See, he's got his Bible. He's really into living a really religious life. I said, no kidding. You know, I'd like to talk to you about that. I couldn't believe this. I ended up getting elected as president of the student body. And in the yearbook they wrote up, we all saw a significant change in Tony when he started carrying his Bible. They were supposed to hate me. The crowd at school put no pressure on me at all. As a matter of fact, the school I went to, I don't know about the school you go to, loved individuality. They loved people who were weird. They loved people who had their own thing, you know, who marched to a beat of a distant drummer. They thought that was cool. I found that they put no pressure on me to conform at all. But let me tell you who did put pressure on me to conform. What? I didn't hear it. What? No. I'll tell you who did put pressure on me to conform. It was the church youth group. Oh man, did they pressure me. They had this little thing. We don't smoke and we don't dance and we don't chew and we don't go with girls who do. And you know, and you had to conform. You know, you had to fit into that. And there were, you know, it took me a long time. I found that Christians talked funny. See, I just came in from the outside. And they talked funny. They didn't talk like other people. They, as a matter of fact, they really didn't even talk. They shared. Did you ever notice that? We have a time of sharing. Sounded like talking, but it was sharing. And they don't have dates. They have times of fellowship. And I had to learn this weird language. And I had to, you know, find out all of this weird stuff. For instance, I learned that, you know, that Baptists do not dance. So I gave up dancing, see? Crazy, man. And then we had a church hayride. Do you have hayrides out here? And I asked what was wrong with dancing. They said it stimulates the lust of the flesh. You should have been on this hayride. I mean, you know this Baptist hayride? People were rolling in the straw. There was this one guy with a guitar singing Do Lord. And everybody else was doing it. You know what I mean? I mean, it was mind-boggling. So it was very hard for me. And I found that there was this whole way of life that the youth group had prescribed. And they used to actually have sessions on why you shouldn't do this and that and the other thing. And if you didn't play the religious game exactly the way they said it had to be played, they accepted you because they were Christians. And Christians accept everybody, even those that we despise. I couldn't believe it. I find that the church is a much more pressure group. Do you find that? Do you find the church just put more pressure on you to conform than the people at school ever do? And people at school, they didn't give a hoot what I did. I had a few things going for me. I was the point guard on the basketball team, and in the Philadelphia high school, that's big. That's big to be the point guard. You say, not you. Have you ever wondered what a jock looks like when he gets old? This is it. But we're here to talk about Christianity and sexuality, and I have to say that I find that of all the things that kids have to combat and deal with and struggle with in their daily lives, sex is the area that's most troublesome. As a matter of fact, the group at school never posed a major threat to my Christian walk. My sexual desires did. I never found myself struggling against the gang at school. I did find myself struggling against my sexual desires because they were pretty powerful with me. I mean, you wouldn't believe that, but that's true. You say, but you're bald-headed. That's true, I am. But when we're born, we're all given so many hormones. And if you want to use yours to grow hair, that's your problem. You understand? Did you get that? Because you didn't even smile at that one, and I thought that was a pretty good line. But the truth of the matter is, that's where, in fact, whenever I slipped away from Jesus, it usually was not because of pressure that kids put on me, but because of things that were going on in my own life sexually. The guilt from doing a lot of stuff. And I found that for me, Christianity didn't work a lot of the time. You know, I became a Christian. I asked Jesus to help me to overcome my sexual temptations. And I would say all the things that ministers were supposed to say, you know. Lord, I'm too weak to overcome this on my own strength. That's what they tell you to say, right? So I said it. Lord, I'm too weak to overcome this in my own strength. Please, strengthen me. And to tell the truth, it didn't work. And if you're a typical teenager and you don't look typical, well, you look. If you're a typical teenager, it works something like this. You get involved with somebody in a dating relationship, and you really don't have... I mean, I don't know many kids who just say, hey, I'm going to jump in the sack and have sex. That's not the way it worked. What would happen is you get involved with somebody, you really like that person, you begin to express some affection, the affection escalates, gets more and more involved. Your hands begin to go places where they shouldn't go. You go home at night, you say to yourself, I think I crossed some lines I shouldn't have crossed. I think I've gotten into some stuff I shouldn't get into. And so you promise God, it's not going to happen again. Lord, I'm sorry, it's not going to happen again. What's more is you go back to this person that you're dating and you say, you know what happened the other night? I think we crossed some lines we shouldn't have crossed. He says, oh, yes. I feel that way, too. I felt so terrible. Yes, yes. We're not going to do it anymore.
Lord, I'm so glad to hear you say that. I can't tell you how happy I am.
Why don't we pray about it? I mean, that really does it, see. And you take her hand and you start praying that the Lord will... Feels pretty good.
And as a matter of fact, as she's crying, you really feel she needs to be hugged a little bit. You know what I mean? Have you been there, Scott? Do you know?
No, Scott, I don't know what you're talking about.
Virgin lips.
What's that?
Virgin lips.
Virgin lips. Is that? Scott was telling me he doesn't even know what kissing is, right? Scott, a kiss is a mouthful of nothing that tastes like heaven and sounds like a cow pulling its foot out of mud. Do you have that? I mean, do you have that? For those who need to be more sexually experienced, may I say that Christians know that there are at least three kinds of kisses. There are peaches, and for deeper intimacy, you have prunes. And my favorite kiss is the alfalfa. You know, that's the one that generally does it. So, do you understand any of this, Scott? I mean, because I see you taking notes furiously, and I. I would make this promise. She would make this promise. We would pray. It would all get spiritual, and the next thing you know, we'd be right back where we were, and then maybe even go a little deeper and a little further. And I have found that the sexual problem remained with me. Now, a lot of people think that once you get married, then it's all over. Then it's all over. See, then you've met this person and that's it. It doesn't stop there. The temptations are there. The inclinations are there. And I was at a youth retreat. And we're all around the fire. You know, you've been at these things, haven't you? These retreats, and everybody's crying. You know, have you ever been in one of these things where you're like, I'm going to give my life back to Jesus? And I'm just crying. And as we're all crying, this one kid I can remember started praying. And he said, Oh Lord, take away my sexual desires. Now that's a stupid prayer. I mean, suppose it was answered. I mean, can you imagine if that was answered? You know, you'd go around shaking hands with girls the rest of your life. Hi, good to meet you. What is your name? Bill? Oh, Mary. Yeah, I'm glad to see you. I mean, I don't know about you, but the reason why sex is so tempting is because it's so much fun. You didn't know that, Scott, but it is fun. And it's a very enjoyable thing, and I don't want it taken from me. Secondly, there's a great awareness about the role of sex. Now, one of the great differences between Roman Catholics and Protestants is how we define the role of sexual intercourse. And for Catholics, it tends to have one primary function, and that's to generate babies. Evangelical Christianity, the Baptist tradition, holds a somewhat different view. Our view is that the sexual act has as its primary purpose to bind people together. It is the ultimate expression of love. It is the ultimate way in which you share your deepest emotions with another person. Consequently, in the Baptist tradition, we look upon the sexual act with great reverence, with great seriousness, because for us, supposedly, it is an activity that expresses our deepest spiritual commitments. Our deepest spiritual commitments. It's physically exciting. It's physically thrilling. For those of you that don't know, take it from me. It's great. But the sexual act for us has a physical thing, it has an emotional thing, and it has a spiritual thing. It's a total involvement with the other person. It's a total involvement. It's spiritual, it's emotional, it's physical. It's total. It's the total giving of yourself to another person. It's a total surrender of yourself for another person. And I got to tell you, there are certain psychological, emotional gratifications that come out of the sexual act that can be achieved no other way. It is an absolutely incredible event. But it is not simply a physical thing. It's a physical thing. It's an emotional thing. It's a spiritual thing. It's sharing on the deepest level. As a matter of fact, the Bible has two words for the act of sexual intercourse. Two words, not one. The one word is new. And it says, you know, you read the scripture, it says, and Adam knew Eve. That's a good word, isn't it? Knew her. There's another word for sexual intercourse. You know what it is? And we use it in the United States in gutter language. But it's in the Bible. It says, for instance, in one place, and Ruth laid with Boaz. And we have a phrase that we use in gutter language. Well, he went out and got laid. Do you use that term over here? Is that part of your dirty language talk? Get laid. It's interesting. That's a biblical term. That sex is described in two ways. You can, in the Bible, you can get laid, or you can know a person. That's a pretty significant contrast, isn't it? In the sexual act, you can come into a relationship that is so profound about this other person. There's a kind of opening up in the sexual act where you really become vulnerable and open up to this other person and get to know this person on the deepest level possible. So they're your two choices in this world. I think they're the two biblical choices. You can go out and get laid, or you can use sex to come to know a person in the deepest way. And I want to talk about those two differentiations, because I have to say that there's no single thing that you can do that will make you more alive and more vibrant as a human being than the sexual act. That is, if the sexual act is built around knowing a person. And there's nothing that will cheapen you and make you feel like trash more than getting laid. And that's not just for the females. Females have this idea that, you know, that when it's all over, they're the ones that are diminished. They're the ones who have been cheapened. I remember reading in Søren Kierkegaard, he's a Danish philosopher, existentialist writer. In his diary, he writes in one place where he visits a house of prostitution, and he comes home and he said, "Tonight, I paid a woman in order to experience how despicable I am." What an interesting statement. I paid a woman. He didn't say, I slept with a whore. It wasn't what it did to her. It was what it did to him. That he felt himself incredibly cheapened and diminished. And so there are two differentials. As an evangelical Christian, I have a strong commitment to saying that sex should take place within the context of marriage. And that's not just because there's a verse someplace that says that. And since the Bible says it, we have to obey it. There's a deeper reason than that, that I hold to that fact. Because in sex, I make myself so vulnerable. I think women even make themselves more vulnerable than men in the sexual act. I think in the sexual act, the male is by definition an aggressor, and no feminist movement is going to change that. You cannot make a man have sex against his will. You cannot rape a man. You can rape a woman. And in the sexual act, she becomes very, very vulnerable. She becomes very, very vulnerable. And you can get hurt because you're so vulnerable. Incredibly hurt. All of us know about teenagers who get hurt, and people have no idea as to the depth of hurt. Most teenage suicides are related to sexuality. People who have just been hurt. All of us, you go to your high school, kids that you know, in your own life, has there ever been anything that has hurt you more than sexual things? I mean, even if you did not have intercourse, I mean, just a lot of you develop intensive love commitments, to intensive romantic commitments. Generally speaking, what we know about emotional turn-ons cross-sexually is that they begin somewhere around 12 and 13 years of age, contrary to a lot of people. They say, well, that's puppy love. It may be puppy love, but it leads to a dog's life. I want to tell you that, because it puts you through tremendous pain. But about 12 or 13, it begins to happen. It's no surprise that Shakespeare sets Romeo and Juliet in their early teens. You knew that. That in the Romeo and Juliet setting of the original play, Juliet, I think, is about 14 years old, and Romeo is about 15 years old. And the reason for that is because Shakespeare, in his genius, understood that the romantic intensive sexual turn-on is probably never stronger than it is at those ages, interestingly enough. I mean, passion is most intense in those middle teenage years. I mean, they're the most intensive time of all. So as I'm talking to you, some of you are 13, some of you are 14, and people are saying, aren't they a little young for this? No, I really wish I could have gotten to you a couple of years earlier. Because by the time you're 14, you are already intensely turned on. And as a matter of fact, it's almost all of life, 14-year-old, 15-year-old kids, I find them difficult to deal with because they're so sexual. You know, they cannot get up and go to the washroom without doing it sexually. You know, I watch, you know, when you're at a church dinner or something where you're the speaker and you're up at the main table, you, as a sociologist, see, that's what I am, you watch people. You notice that when a guy's got to go to the washroom, what does he do? He gets up and he walks out, right? That's it. Do you ever notice women do not do that? Girl's got to go to the washroom, she nudges about three or four other girls. And at a given signal, the whole group get up and march out together. Did you ever notice that? Have you ever noticed that? You're not very observant, are you? Because when they do that, you never know which one really has the problem. Do you know what I mean? You never know. See, now guys do not do that, right? I mean, if you're at a dinner with a bunch of guys, you don't get the guy next to you and say, hey, John, I'm going to the men's room. Want to come? They would arrest you. You know what I mean? They'd throw the key away. It's a very, very different ballgame, the difference between men and women. But they're very... Whenever you're at a... set, like, you know, I'm watching last night. You know, there's 1,500 people there. And there are some girls who are there with less than spiritual intent. You can count on them at a particular point. Not only getting up, but making a big display out of marching out, hoping that Charlie over there will notice. We still live in a male chauvinistic society. So that you need to listen to this, because this is very important. Very important. Are you ready? Okay. Because we're still in a world where girls do not come up and ask us for dates, for the most part. Which means the girls have developed this technique to get us to ask. As best as I can describe it, it's called zapping. See, you're at a church social, and you're over there with the guys, and you're eating some cookies and drinking some punch, and she's on the other side of the room. Are you listening? And she zaps you. And you're not even aware of this. All you know is you find yourself jerked over. They stare at the back of your head and you don't even know they're doing it. This is true. Do not pretend it's not true. I'm a scientist. I have observed this. She's been looking. As a matter of fact, you were made a mistake to sit up front. The smart guys are the ones right back there on the last row, man. Nobody's going to hit their heads, right? Right, guys? You knew the name of the ballgame. I'm getting back here, man, with my back to the wall. No woman's going to get the back of my head. But there's this whole world is so sexual. I really do have to say that you make yourself so vulnerable in the sexual act. You put yourself in a position where you can be hurt. I mean, when you make yourself sexually open, you put yourself in a place where you can be hurt incredibly. And that's why, if I'm going to commit the sexual act, I want a commitment from the other person. I want a commitment from the other person. And since the sexual act in the Bible is seen as so important, the Bible says, I want a commitment for the rest of your life. A commitment that goes on forever. That's why Jesus is pretty strong against divorce. He's pretty specific against it. Somebody got me, I don't know how many of you were last night, but somebody got me last night and really hit me about my sympathetic comments to homosexuals. I got to tell you. You know what Jesus says about homosexuality? Do you know what Jesus says? Now, Paul says something about it, but do you know what Jesus says about homosexuality? Anybody? You mean nobody knows what he says about homosexuality? I didn't expect that I would get an answer, because the truth is, he doesn't say anything about it. It's not one of his biggies. It's not on his list of most important concerns. As a matter of fact, he has a great deal to say about religious people that are going around condemning everybody else. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not lending approval to homosexual behavior. I'm just saying that what Jesus was much more concerned about is sexuality without commitment. See, when he speaks against divorce, it's not that he's against divorce. He's against sex without commitments. He's against people getting laid. He wants people to have sexual relationships in which they actually do know each other in the deepest level. I'm married 35 years now. And I got to tell you, I heard my wife give a speech the other day. And she said, I've been married three different times. So that I didn't know about this woman. She said, I was married three different times. I've had three separate marriages. All three of them were to the same person, which is an interesting way of saying it. There was the Peggy I married. Very traditional woman. I mean, you know, I'm 58. When I got married, there was a role prescribed for women. Remember that role? You know, where you got married and you had babies and you kept house and the only status you had was assigned to you from your husband. The old patriarch system, and that's the way we got married. And that's the way everybody did it then. And at a particular point, she went through what we call consciousness raising. And she became a different person and began to look at marriage differently. And she forced me to do it. And so she changed and I changed. And I would have to say both of us became radically different people, which raises the question. Are the same people now married to each other? We have the same physical bodies, but we're two completely different people. And then about 4 years ago, she went through another major transition in her life. She had her life, I had my life, and we respected each other. But you wouldn't guess this about me, but the thing that I do for a living is, and I make no apologies for it, I'm an intellectual. I read, I write, I do research. I love this. I get paid for sitting in coffee shops with other scholars and discussing great ideas. It's a great way to make a living. And that was never her thing. And I respected that. But a few years ago, she became very, very interested in certain things and started reading, and she has become a scholar. So all of a sudden now, she becomes an intellectual partner. So, you see, we never stopped learning about each other. It's like getting all married all over again. I would say, when I think about it, maybe I've had 20 marriages, all to the same person. Because she's changing and I'm changing, and we constantly have to get to know each other. And in this, do you understand that? You see, what happens to a guy like you, how old are you? 21. What happens to a guy at 21 is very simple. You start dating a girl, And if you date her long enough, she changes or you change. That is, if you don't get married. If you don't get married, this is what happens to somebody like you. You start dating a girl. Are you dating her? Just want to check, because I didn't want to mess. I do not want to mess anything up here. Do you know what I mean? But you start dating a girl, and it's really great for a while, and then all of a sudden you find you're not clicking anymore. Don't you find this to be the case? You're not clicking anymore. And, you know, when you finally get around to breaking up, you realize that she's kind of relieved. Because she wasn't clicking with you either. And you say, well, I don't know, it just died. No, it wasn't. She changed. You changed. And since there was no commitment to stay together, right? Since there was no commitment to stay together, when you changed and she changed, what happened? You said, well, see you later. And you took up with somebody else who was more in tune with where you were. But if you stay with that person long enough, you'll change and she'll change, and guess what? The same thing will happen again. You're saying, are you suggesting that there are no lasting romantic relationships? My answer is absolutely. Absolutely. You say, what are you suggesting? You get married, you make it... That's right. Being married is being committed to somebody who you're going to stay with even after you don't feel like it. You know, I mean, this happily ever after crap is a lot of crap. Yeah, that's what it is. You know what I mean? Yeah, this is the whole image of the culture, right? You meet this person, and you cock an eye at her, and she cocks an eye at you, and you look at each other cockeyed. And and I know what you're going to say. You're going to say, I don't like this. Because I believe when you meet the right one. Oh, there's a cute one. The right one. And you ask your mother, Mom, how will I know when I've met the right one? And your mother says, when you meet the right one, that really helps, doesn't it? I mean, that clarifies. Gee, I'm glad you answered me. You know, when you meet the right one, you'll know. And it doesn't end there, Scott. 3 weeks before you get married, she will say this. Are you... Sure. People, it's too late. The invitations are out. The presents are coming in. You're dead meat. Let me tell you what will happen to you, Scott. I can't... What's your name? You can't not tell... Because I've never been in your shoes. And I'll never be in your shoes. But your shoes, I know what it's like to be the guy in the front of the church. This is what's going to happen. Everybody you know is going to be there. And you feel there's no escape, and there is none. And you look up the aisle, and this woman, dressed in white, who you hardly recognize, is coming at you, and she is wearing this demonic grin on her face. And you're saying, God, what am I doing here? And even if you are an atheist, at that moment, God will speak to you. You will hear a voice from heaven saying, too late, sucker. I hate to disillusion you, but this is the way it is. What's your name? Allison? Yes.
She's married.
Yeah, let me tell you what it's like. You wake up one morning, you look across the bed, there she is. She's not awake yet. Her mouth is open. Her hair is hanging down. Worse than that, she wakes up first and looks across the bed. And there is no hair hanging down. It's very, very hard to stay romantic. It's very hard to maintain romance with somebody you have to live with. I had to take a course in marriage counseling. I am not a marriage counselor. I told you, I am a researcher, a reader, an intellectual. I'm an idea person. I do not counsel. So if you need marriage counseling, do not come to me. I am lousy at it. I will end up yelling at you. I always start off so well. Person says, I'm a pervert. I'm a dirty, filthy, sexual pervert. And I always start off, you know, tell me about it. And 20 minutes later, I'm yelling, you are a pervert. So I'm really not good at this. I am really not good at this. I had to take this course because my advisor said, one out of every four couples in America gets marriage counseling. You have to know the dynamics simply because it's impacting the society at large, and you have to understand how the social dynamics impact. Oh, geez, so I took the course. They signed me with this to work with this young woman. She, brilliant, brilliant young woman. I was young at the time. It was great to work with her. She was such a scholarly person. And she hated counseling, too. She was no good at it either. We were the two ducks in the class. I mean, we had no abilities. Dr. Bossert, who was running the program, assigned to us a couple that he later admitted could not be helped. You can see his logic, can't you? They couldn't be helped. We couldn't help anybody. You know, you put us together, nothing, you know, nobody can get hurt, see? We're into this thing about 3 weeks. Nothing is happening. Nothing is happening. Finally, I said to the guy, you come back next week. I said to the woman, we don't want to see you anymore. You're the problem. You say, that's terrible. It's always a gestalt. It's always an interactive process. You can never blame it. I assure you, it was his fault. So I said, don't come back anymore. So he came in the next week. We talked for about 2 hours. I pulled every trick out of the trade. The Rogerian technique, a little bit of transactional analysis, the conjugate therapies. We tried every system. Nothing worked. Finally, I did what you should never do in a professional counseling situation. I reached across the table and I grabbed him and I shook him and I yelled, what is wrong with you? And he started to cry. That wasn't the worst part. When he started to cry, Kathy, my partner, started to laugh. So this is a bad situation. This guy's like, Kevin's died, rolled off the chair. Bad situation. Your client is crying. Your partner's laughing. He said it fell apart the night of the honeymoon. That really got me. I said, the honeymoon? See, now, let me tell you. I said that romanticism tends to diminish about 80% in intensity over the first 2 years of marriage. But most people make it through the honeymoon, right? I mean, no problem getting through the honeymoon. So what happened? He said, we were in the hotel room. He said, I had the music on low, the lights down low. I was in bed. I was really ready. Do you know what I mean? What am I supposed to say? Yes, I think I know what you mean. He said, she took her negligee. She went into the bathroom to get ready. And then he started crying again. And I said, what happened? He said, she ruined everything. The mood was perfect. Everything was perfect. She ruined everything. I said, what did she do? He said, she went to the toilet. I looked at Kathy. He said, you don't understand. I said, I understand perfectly. You eat, you digest. This happens. He said, you don't understand. I'm lying in bed romantically waiting for her. And she not only went to the toilet, but while she was doing it, she made terrible noises. I started to laugh. I mean, you can just see what happened. He did not marry a woman, a human being. He married a romantic image that floated into the room with her hair perfect, her posture perfect, everything about her perfect. That's what he married, an image. And that image, that night, was literally blown away. They never tell you this before you get married, but marriage is bad noises. Worse than that, it's bad smells. You go in afterwards and you say, who died in here? It's easy to be romantic when you don't have to live with the person. You know, when you meet them for that lovely date. But when you have to live with somebody day in and day out, and the question is very simple. Dating is a totally artificial relationship. It's not real. It's not real. And if you engage in sexuality, in sexual activity, sexual intercourse, on a date, you have made yourself vulnerable to somebody that you don't even know. You just think you know them. You don't have any idea who this person is until after you're married. And you have to live with them when they're not on stage. Say, geez, I never knew, right? You learn more about your husband in the first month after you were married than you did in all the time you were dating him. It's a time of incredible revelation. And the Bible says, I don't want you to mess around with sex until there's a commitment to stay with this person. Because the first reaction when you really get to know the person is to want to get out of the relationship. I assure you. It's your first reaction. The reason why I stayed married is because I'm a Christian. Christians are supposed to stay married. And I stayed married. And then after that period of disillusionment, and there was a period of disillusionment, we began to get to know each other again. And I discovered all kinds of wonderful things about her. And incidentally, the sexual activity was going on the whole time. And it was part of me getting reconnected. If you were to chart my marriage, it would be like this. There were two people who were apart, who came together. And after a while, began to drift apart. And then after a while, came together again. And apart, and together, and apart, and together. I'll tell you why. You've all experienced this in the dating game. Here's what happens. When you start dating a person, you really enjoy that person's individuality. But the more you get close to the person, the more something happens. We can't help ourselves. Each of us tries to recreate the other person in our own images. Did you ever date somebody and have the feeling, this guy wants to change me? I mean, he doesn't like me the way I am. In the beginning he did, but he wants me to change and be like him. And don't be nasty about it, because there's a strong likelihood that not only is he trying to change you, but you're trying to change him. It's that way in marriage as well. We're in the process. And finally, at a certain point, you say, hey, wait a minute. This relationship is smothering me. Have you ever dated somebody and had that feeling? This is smothering me. If I stay in this relationship, I'm not going to be me anymore. And you have to kind of establish some distance. But when you establish that distance, guess what? You miss the person. And so you come back together again into a new period of intimacy. But the same thing happens. And you come apart, and you come together, and you come apart. And here's the good thing. Each time my wife and I have become somewhat alienated from each other and developed ourselves as individuals. My wife, you know, goes into the women's movement and I've got to become my own person. And she did. But when we came together again, she brought with her all the rich experiences that she picked up in that period when she was trying to establish our individuality. My marriage, my relationship with my wife, in case you can't figure out, is somebody I love very much. As a matter of fact, I can say this. I may not be as romantic, and I'm not, as I was the day I got married. But I love my wife more today, so much more today than the day. I'm not even sure I did love her the day I was married. I was romantically turned on. But romance is very selfish. Stop to consider how selfish romance is. Every romantic song you know is selfish. I need you. I want you. I can't get along without you, baby. I, me, right? How often in making love do we not even recognize how selfish it is? What's your name again?
Katrina.
Katrina. You know, have you ever had this laid on you? Katrina, I can't tell you what you mean to me. I don't think I can... You haven't actually. Well, let me do it to you now. Give you a cheap thrill for the day. You know, I don't know that I can go on living without you. Without you, my life has no meaning. And all that sounds beautiful except for one fact. What? The whole purpose of this girl is to do what? Satisfy my needs. Love is not as self-centered as romance. Romance is very self. So I was incredibly romantic. Being Baptist, you know, I didn't do anything before I got married. Do you know what I mean by that, Scott? I, you know, didn't do it. I grew up singing this little song. Be careful, little hands, what you do. Did you learn this in Daily Vacation Bible School? Did you learn this song? How many learned this in Sunday school? Just out of curiosity. Did you know this song? Be careful, little hands, what you do. God is up above. And, you know, in the kindergarten you sing this. And you do the motions. He is looking down in love. So be careful, little hands, what you do. That song ruined my dating life. I would be in a car. I'd be ready to move on a girl. I'd hear this voice from heaven saying, be careful, little hands, what you do. So the day I got married, I hadn't done anything. You know what I mean? And I was hot to trot. Does that translate over here in this culture? I mean, I was foaming at the mouth. And I got married. And because I believe in a biblical concept of marriage, I became committed to this person, for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, till death do us part. When marriage is done, I'll tell you quite frankly, has kept me married to somebody that I wouldn't have stayed with otherwise. It's a strange thing to say. And of all the blessings that I've ever had, that's the most important. But because I was stuck, I had to create love. So you don't have to create romance. You do have to create love. One of my students in the sociology of the family, that's the fancy name for the sex course at the university, sociology of the family, asked me quite pointedly, since I was 58 years old, what's the difference between making love at 18 or 28 and 58? And I said this, that young men make love with their hands. And old guys like me make love with their eyes. The most meaningful times that I have with my wife is when we're just sitting down face to face, and with all the spiritual power within me, I reach through her eyes and reach down into the depths of her being and touch her soul. And even as I'm doing that, I feel her reaching through my eyes. Let me ask you young folk a simple question. Have you ever learned how to look into a person? It's an interesting question. Have you ever learned how to look into a person? Or do you only know how to look at a person? If there's anything I hate about this world we live in, it's that we evaluate people in terms of what we see when we look at them. And there's a big difference between looking at a person and looking into a person. Being a Christian is being spiritually empowered, spiritually energized. And with that power, I find myself able to reach through a person's eyes and reach down into the depths of a person's being and feel my way into that person's soul. I watch young people on dates. Let me say, when I go into a restaurant, I can look around. That's what sociologists do. My wife says, a sociologist is somebody who, when an attractive woman walks into a room, looks at everybody else. We're always doing that. But as I go into restaurants and watch people at tables, they break down into categories. There are the young lovers, the romantics. And you know, they're easy to discern. You know why they're easy to discern? They're talking a mile a minute, and they're laughing. Oh, he's saying something. Oh, she's laughing. She thinks he's the funniest thing that's ever come down the pike. And everything he says is so clever. And oh, they're loud. They're laughing all the time. Generally, they're obnoxious. There they are. It's delightful. It's the little relationship that we sing about. Hello, young lovers, wherever you are. I was a young lover. I was once young, too. I remember that. You know, when you went on a date, and the worst thing that could happen is for the conversation to stop. So most of you live with that fear. I have it. You go out on a date and say, what if I get halfway through the date and I don't know what to say? Have you ever seen a couple on dates and they're both sitting there? Neither of them know what to say. I mean, that's frightening. But when there's a real romantic thing, you're like, oh, I had so much fun. That's the big thing. I had so much fun. Oh, he's so funny. I just had such a good time being with him. He's laughing, laughing, laughing. He's a riot. Oh, blah, you know. But you got that, you know. So you see those people. Then you see the couple that's been married for 30 years. And the whole thing's dead. And he's sitting there like this. You seen those couples? She's looking down like this. And they just sit there. And they just sit there like bumps on a log. And they're so unhappy. And then there's people like my wife and me. You know, we've talked for a long time, having been married for 35 years. We still have a lot to say to each other. But I got to tell you, of all the things that I enjoy, it's when I just sit there and she reaches into me and I reach into her and we connect. And you say nothing at all. It was this that Sir Thomas More once wrote. Believe me, when all those endearing young charms, which I gaze on so fondly today, were to fade by tomorrow and all pass away, thou wouldst still be beloved as this moment thou art, though thy loveliness fade as it may. Lao Tse, the founder of the Taoist religion in China, once asked a man, do you love your wife? The man said, yes. He said, describe her. The man described his wife in detail. And when he finished, Lao Tse said, you don't love her. If you loved her, you could not have described her. What an interesting thing. Once you've reached through a person's eyes and reached down into the depths of a person's being, then anything that you see from the outside is so unimportant, you gradually forget it. I got to tell you, there are times I forget what my wife even looks like. This is what the Apostle Paul means when he writes, we no longer know each other after the flesh, but in the spirit. And let me just tell you, quite frankly, there's a tendency in the Australian culture, like the American culture, for people to get married in terms of what they see when they look at each other. And that's why marriages aren't working in America, and that's why they're not working in this country. People say, what you see is what you get. Not at all. It's what you don't see that is really important. And sex, for me, is a relationship, a physical act, in which I not only make myself physically vulnerable, but emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually vulnerable to this other person. This other person, I give control of my life over to this person. This person can crush me, and I can crush her. And we dare not take those kinds of risks without a commitment, without a deep and abiding commitment. Let me stop there and just have a few minutes. I was going to give you a chance to ask questions, but I just talked and talked and talked, didn't I? Like a sex maniac. Once I got on the subject, you couldn't stop me, man. I just foamed at the mouth. Do you have a question or two? Yes.
And I believe that will work for each other. I would be right for them. If it was supposed to be, I just thought about it then. Then have sex before marriage and just enter into marriage.
Well, first of all, let me be very direct with you. What is marriage?
Commitment.
Okay, so then why would you have sex without a commitment?
For your own desire.
That would be wrong. It would be wrong because you're getting laid. It's a physical, you have a physical appetite, you're using the other person to gratify your physical appetite. And I'll tell you, there is nothing that diminishes a human being more than that sense that she, and sometimes he, was physically used to satisfy somebody's appetite. You dare not. People are too precious to be used. You use things. Eric Fromm said this. The problem with our age is that we have come to love things and use people instead of using things and loving people. When you use somebody sexually for your own gratification, you make that person into a thing. That's why the feminists, who aren't particularly Christian, are absolutely right. When you use a woman for sexual gratification, you have turned her into an object, into a thing that provides a good feeling for you. Human beings deserve something better from you than to be used. The reason why I asked the question was simple. That the sexual act is marriage. The sexual act is marriage. When you enter into the sexual act, here's what the Bible says about marriage. It describes marriage in these terms. It doesn't say you are married when the clergyman performs a ceremony. It says, and the two become one flesh. Marriage is the sexual act. The ceremony is simply the people saying to the world, we are making this commitment. And the reason why it's important to say it to the world is because it's saying it to the world that keeps you from going back on it. That public declaration traps you. You say, are you suggesting that I should get trapped? I'm saying, until you get trapped in a romantic relationship through marriage, you'll probably never figure out what love is all about. For reasons that I gave you. When romantic relationships begin to peter out, what do? You move on to another person. Do you know people in your society who get married, have a romantic relationship, it peters out, they divorce them, marry on to another person? We live in a throwaway society. You've heard that, haven't you? And what is more frightening is that people have become throwaway items. When a car gets old, we get rid of it. When our clothes get out of style, we get rid of it. I can't tell you how sick and tired I am of 45-year-old men dumping their wives of 20 years to marry some young chickadee. I find it abominable. Here's what Paul says. When I was a child, I understood as a child. I thought as a child. When I became a man, I put away childish things. Now, Katrina, you're a very lovely young woman. But I got to tell you something. You don't turn me on. I mean, you're saying, hey, the feeling's mutual. But that's the truth. You don't turn me. I mean, I got to tell you, when you're 50, any 50-year-old, 8-year-old guy who gets turned on by 22-year-old women is a sick man. I mean, I teach university. I have all these attractive young women. You know, I come in the room and say, hi. And she says, oh, hi, Dr. Campolo. You know, I'm married. My wife loves to watch me with young women. She loves to stand on the side and just laugh. Yeah, you're making a fool out of yourself again. I mean, it's a whole funny thing. You just... But we get caught up in this kind of thing. And I said to my wife the other day, I said, you know, I got to tell you, I can't think of you being more attractive than you are right now. And she said, you're not being objective. I said, of course I'm not being objective. I haven't been married for 35 years to be objective. It's taken me 35 years to enter into your subjective character and to feel my way into your soul. And you're saying I'm not being objective. Anybody can be objective. Only I know who you are. And that's what love is. Here's what it says in the Great Love chapter. We know in part, we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. Before love what? We looked at each other. Do you know that passage in the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians? We looked at each other as though through a glass darkly. But then, see that eye-to-eye thing, then face-to-face. It's a whole other thing. There was another question back there? Yeah.
Do you think that they can be loved before marriage? Before you said that before you were married and now looking back, you kind of didn't know what you were loved
before. I think love is what you create when you want to get away from the person. And I don't know if a sociologist would disagree with me, Eric Fromm or M. Scott Peck. The truth of the matter is, why would you... I think that before marriage, if you want to get away from a person, guess what you do? What do you think you do when there's some girl you want to get away from? You get away from her. Isn't that true? It may take you a little time. I mean, it'll come like this if she wants to get rid of you. What's your name?
Kent.
Kent. One night, she'll say, Kent, friendship can be a beautiful thing. Guys, how many of you have had the friendship line pulled on you? Yeah, you know you're dead meat. The minute that they start that friendship thing, you're dead. But the very thing that people condemn marriage for is what I like about it. It forces you to stay with somebody and to work through something that if you weren't stuck in the relationship, you would never bother to work through. And that's why I don't think... What's that?
What if you would?
Well, there's always the hypothetical case. But I can't imagine you being attached to a person that you basically can't stand and continuing to date that person indefinitely. Now, maybe you can. In which case, you're on your way. Love is... See, the difference between romance and love is romance kind of happens. I grew up on romance. Some enchanted evening, you will meet a stranger across a crowded room. I spent my teenage years looking across crowded rooms. And somehow you'll know. Most romance is almost instantaneous. It's almost instantaneous. Most of you have romantic turn-ons. The turn-on doesn't develop gradually. Generally, a romantic turn-on is almost instantaneous. You see her and you say, oh, ding, 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 went the trolley. Bung, 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 went the train. Clang, 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 went my heartstrings. Every old pirate movie, you know, Earl Flynn comes charging onto the deck of the ship and with waving his sword, and he meets her and their eyes meet. Right? And you know. It happened. Romance is that quick. And I'm not knocking romance. As a matter of fact, I would have never gotten married if it wasn't for romance. Romance got me married. It's a very powerful force. May I say, I think that romance is even more intense than love. I have seen people walk away from their kids and their families because of romantic turn-ons, haven't you? Only to be disillusioned 2 years later and wish they could undo the whole mess that they've created. I have watched ministers ruin their churches because of romantic turn-ons with people that they shouldn't be haven't you? Don't tell me romance is light stuff. It's heavy stuff. It's dangerous stuff. But love is deliberately created, and it takes, for instance, I think that the phrase, I'm in love, is a bad phrase. I think the phrase, I'm romantically turned on, is a good one. But I'm not in love yet. I am becoming more loving every day. Anybody who's been in this for any length of time knows that love is a process. It is a growing thing. I am not there yet. If I signed any of your books, any of my books, if I sign them, if I always sign my name and put a verse right underneath it, which is Philippians 3:14, which reads, not as though I have already attained or have already achieved, I am still pressing towards the mark. With Robert Browning, I say to my wife, the best is yet to come. And I look at young people who are all gagged over each other, and I remember how exciting it was. But I also know that there's something even deeper and more profound that they can't even guess at. So being in love is not anything that I think you're in. I think you grow towards it. And I don't think you're fully in love until it's all... That's what heaven's for. So, you know, when somebody says, but we're really in love, therefore isn't sex okay? My response is, I don't think you are in love. Anything's possible, let me just say. I just have been studying relationships as a business for too long. And I guess the thing that bothers me the most, and I'll say this strongly, is that I've spent a good chunk of my life picking up the discarded trash that's been left behind by people who have used people and dumped them along the way. I mean, I'm a pacifist. You know what that means? I would never go to war or anything like that. And I have to, because I got to tell you, in my experience of dealing with young people over the years, there are a lot of guys I would love to kill. I would just love to kill them. Because I've seen them use up one girl after another, after another, after another, and leave them behind, shattered and battered and almost suicidal. And you feel like saying, somebody's got to stop this guy. And I could do it with a .32 revolver. And the world would not be the less for it. I mean, I hate to say that, but it is a pretty... I have never seen such meanness and such cruelty as in the romantic world. As a matter of fact, let's be honest. When I talked about breaking up, I talked about it in such casual terms. I've very seldom seen people break up in a casual manner. Generally speaking, the people end up hating each other. There's pain and suffering in romantic breakups that stagger my imagination. And I just don't think that we ought to be going around hurting each other like that. When we do break up, here's the one thing I do ask of you as Christians. When it's over, and it will be, you'll have relationships and you'll realize at a certain point, I think this is over. For goodness sakes, don't do what I find most Christian people do. Say, what is it that they do? The guy's dating the girl. It's done. It's over. He doesn't have it anymore. So what does he do? Does he tell her? No. This is what he does. He starts treating her like dirt, hoping that if he's mean enough, guess what? She'll break off with him, and he won't have to do the dirty work. Is that a fair statement? Christians are honest. Nothing's crueler than to put that person through that period of agony. And most of us have been through it, right? Where we sense something's gone wrong. And we don't know what it is. And we try harder and harder. And the harder we try, the nastier the other person gets. And we're beside ourselves wondering what we're doing wrong. And by the time they finish with us, we are so strung out that we're suicidal. Now please, you're a very unusual person if I didn't just describe an episode in your life. You're a very unusual person if I just didn't describe an episode in your life. Where you got turned on to somebody, you developed a romantic relationship, it was going well, and then suddenly you began to feel something change on the other side, and the person started treating you meaner and meaner, and you tried harder and harder, and you smiled and tried, and nothing worked. And you the panic began to overtake you and the hurt began to become very extreme. Just as I said, romance is the most intensive relationship. I don't think that there is any hurt like the hurt of a broken relationship. As hard as it is to sit down with a person when you know it's over and say person to person, this is very hard for me to do, but I have to tell you, I don't feel what I used to feel. And I want to be free from this relationship. It's a very painful thing to do, but it's a very honest thing to do. And Christians are called to be honest. There was another question back there. Yes? There's a very interesting verse of scripture that usually isn't applied to sex, but it should be. It's when Jesus says, cast not your pearls before swine. I don't like to say this but there's a lot of guys out there who are pigs. And you can take your precious self and throw yourself there, and the scripture says it will. Because if you throw pearls before swine, the swine will trample them under their feet. I contend that the risks are just too great. They're too great for a variety of reasons. But most important of all, let me just say this. I think that the sexual act is so important that it ought to be publicly celebrated. Now, we don't do it quite as much as they do it in the Middle East. Any of you ever been to the Middle East? They have a custom there where on the night of the wedding, they actually take the sheet off the bed and put it on a flagpole and fly it out in front of the house. And supposedly, if you have sex for the first time, there's supposed to be some blood on the sheet. That isn't always the case, incidentally. And there's supposed to be some stains on there. And the whole community celebrates. Well, I think that would be a bit too much. But the idea of the whole community coming together and celebrating this incredible event, the two people that they know and love are going to commit themselves to creating something between them that didn't exist before. It deserves community celebration. And it deserves prayers. Because it's difficult to make these relationships. If you want to keep it private, I think good relationships need prayers. So I want the community involved, praying for me, sustaining me, helping me.
But what happens with the notion of being bound for a person?
Well, my point is this. If you had sex before marriage, you didn't really have it. Because in a sense, I said the sexual act is designed to be. If you had sex before marriage, I made my point. You got laid. I hate to put it in those terms, but you got laid.
Would it be special for the person to take it married
to another person? Yeah, I think it can be special. Yeah. I think that what the whole name of the game is for spirituality is that what I said last night. Were you there? Last night or the night before, I said, when Jesus forgives, your sin is not only forgiven, it's forgotten, it's buried in the deepest sea, it's remembered no more. I think that getting laid is sinful. I think that getting laid is sinful. Because it is taking something that God designed to involve the whole person and experiencing it in a way that does not involve the whole person. I don't know. I can't think of it. I can't think of it.
So wouldn't it have any effect?
It has an effect.
What effect?
Well, God forgets, but I think we all remember, don't we? We all carry these things with us into our new relationship. And we can't undo the past. We can't undo the past. Once you've given your virginity away, you can't get it back.
But what is losing virginity?
What is?
What is losing virginity? Is that intercourse or is it like oral? Because in a lot of books that I've read on various subjects, it always says that intercourse isn't losing virginity so much as oral sex as well.
Well, let me just say, I'm a traditionalist. And I would hold to a pretty traditional view that it is the sexual act itself. Now, what has happened in our culture, which is very, very interesting, is that sexual petting has come to be a pretty hot stuff. You know what I mean by that? That very often people become very sexually experienced and involved without having intercourse itself. Do you follow me? And that's what you're referring to, isn't it? It's not the same thing as going all the way. We all know that. But even that, I think when we start messing around below the waist, we've crossed some barriers. Is that a fair statement? I know I've gone a lot further than a lot of ministers would allow me to go. But I think these things through all the time, and I try to watch what it does to people. And I think that below the waist stuff begins to... I'll tell you what happens below the waist. You quickly find yourself, male or female, out of control. And what is more interesting is that I think the female gets more out of control than the male does below the waist. So I have to draw some lines. And I say that once you're out of control with a person, you've given away something. It's my own belief. At that point, I'm not going to hold the Bible up on you. Do you follow me? I'm telling you what I think. And when it comes to the intercourse thing and the whole thing, I think that the Bible does say some things. So, you know, there's the Bible stuff, and I'm also saying where I am as a person. I think your questions are honest. And I'm not saying that I'm even necessarily right. I'm just saying, you ask me a question, I'm giving you my answer, and you can only take it as my answer. I don't have a verse that says, if you do it beneath the waist, you're going to hell and you'll burn forever. You know, I wish there was a verse to control dirty old boys like you, but there is no verse like that. Well, I'm just saying out of my own experience, and I'm trying to be as honest as possible. Yes? I'm on the one, let's say, let's accept AIDS like any other disease. Let me just say, from a biblical perspective, all disease is the result of sin. We evangelical Christians believe that sickness entered the world because of sin, do we not? If Adam and Eve, as we argue, had never sinned, there would be no sickness and death in the world. Is this what we believe? Therefore, if you got a cold, it's because sin is in the world.
And
let me just put it this way. If everybody that committed a sexual sin came down with a disease like AIDS, we'd all be in the hospital. Except for Scott here. do you know what I mean? We'd all be in the hospital. I mean, the sheer idea that one thing is worse than another. You know, where does this homophobia of evangelical Christianity come from anyway? I mean, we have sins, and then we have super sins.
But what I'm saying is, like, say emphysema. Okay? We can say emphysema is a direct result of smoking.
Yeah.
So that now, in the Christian church, we don't tend to hear AIDS is a result of being a homosexual, like we hear smoking is emphysema is a result. Can we say that?
Well, let me just be frank with you and say it's the place where it is really devastating is in Africa, and there it is. A heterosexual disease. In the United States, it tends to be primarily homosexual. It's a sexually communicated disease. Please don't get me wrong. I am not justifying promiscuity. But if you've got a God who every time somebody commits a sin, visits that person with a death-creating disease, we're in trouble. I mean, if that's your concept of God, you sinned, I'll get you. Your insides will rot. I mean, if that's your concept of God, it's a pretty bleak picture. I'm not approving of promiscuity, nor do I believe that the Bible allows for promiscuity. But I
did come to you with that situation where they had an STD or AIDS or whatever.
I mean, is there a homosexual who gets AIDS who's going to say to you after he's gotten AIDS, this had nothing to do with my sexual promiscuity?
What if you're a junkie, though? A junkie, though.
Yeah. Well, Arthur Ashe got it through a blood transfusion.
But that, I'm just saying in the majority of cases, it is a result of lifestyle, whether it's drug use or sexual practices. And even in Africa, where it's heterosexual, it's still sexual practices. But I'm just saying, where's our place? That's what I want to find out. Where's our place to...
Very answer, easy. Judgment is mind, saith the Lord. That's a good place to be. Judgment is mind, saith the Lord. I think that for us to be going around doing that sort of thing and saying those kinds of things only does a disservice to Jesus. Only does a disservice to God. And only confirms the worst suspicions that the secular world has about Christianity. That we're all a bunch of pious, judgmental people who go around condemning people. Let me just say, I find sin abhorrent in my own life. I find sins abhorrent in everybody's life. And in a sense, something's gone wrong with the world. That's why the environment's messed up. That's why people get sick with cancer. Something's gone wrong in the world. Let me tell you what Jesus says. It's a good statement, isn't it? They bring him a man who's sickened with leprosy and palsy. And they throw the man before him. And here's what they say. Why is this man sick? Is it his sin or the sin of his fathers? Sounds like a lot of preachers I know. And Jesus says, I don't want to even hear this. This is an opportunity for us to show glory to God. I was speaking in Sacramento, California, which is a city about the size of Brisbane. It's about the same size. It was a Billy Graham-like thing. 100 churches had gotten together. They hired out the Arco Arena, this big arena that held 20. And we had hundreds of counselors. It was a fully evangelistic, full-blown kind of thing. Mass choir, all bit. Place packed out. There were about 500 decisions the first night. The committee was higher than a kite except for one thing. They said the newspaper gave us no coverage. We had 20,000 people here today. 500 made decisions and the newspaper didn't cover us. I said, big deal. Big deal. I said, Mick Jagger's was here. In this very arena, 2 weeks ago. He filled the place. Did that make the newspapers? I said, come to think of it, he didn't. I said, filling an arena with 20,000 people screaming and yelling and saying hallelujah is not big news. I said, I'll tell you, if you want to make the newspaper, let me make a suggestion. All the money I get on speaking engagements goes into our missionary program. I had a missionary organization. That's the way I support it. See, with book royalty. So buy a book. And so it's no skin off my nose. Here's the way it works. All the money you're going to give me is not going to go to me. It's going to go to the missionary efforts that we have in Haiti and in the inner city of America. So tomorrow night, when we take up the offering, let's designate the entire offering to people in the city of Sacramento who are suffering from AIDS. And we're just going to give it to them. We're just going to divvy it up. There's 100 people that have AIDS. We're going to take the offering, divide it up into 100 pieces, and give it out to people. Not even a big medical program. That's it. So that they can buy medicine, because the medicine costs are astronomically high. I said, and put out a press release to the newspapers, to the television stations, that the offering at the revival meetings is going to go to AIDS. You can guess what happened. The next night, all three television channels were there with their cameras. Every newspaper from 50 miles around was there to cover the story. The choir sang. The press paid no attention. People gave their testimonies. They didn't care. I stood up and preached. I watched them. They were, you know, they were visiting with each other. They could not have cared less. You know what they were waiting for? They were waiting for the end of the service when we took up the offering. I never saw anything like it. They're passing the plate. The cameras go on. The lights go on. Then they interviewed people coming out of the auditorium. And the first guy they interviewed, I mean, he was perfect. He's one of these fat guys with an old T-shirt, you know. And, you know, he had this pop belly, so the shirt kind of hung out here. You know, it couldn't tuck in. I mean, I didn't see a tattoo, but he could have easily have had one. You know, one of these Neanderthal types. You know, he comes out with his belly and a dirty T-shirt. And they come up and say, excuse me, sir, what did you feel about the offering tonight? What did you think of the offering tonight? The guy looked at him and said, what about it? He said, well, the offering went to people with AIDS. I said, so? He said, well, AIDS people in America, for the most part, are homosexuals. Don't you think that was strange? That a group of Christians should give money to people who are undoubtedly homosexuals? And this guy was perfect. He said, look, I don't know nothing about this homo stuff. All I know is that when people are sick, Christians are supposed to help them. Now that's a great line. And that's our point. The question is not why did they get the sickness? The question is, are we going to glorify God by the way in which we respond to it? When they brought Jesus, the man with palsy and leprosy, and said, whose sin is it that made him sick? He said, hey, I don't know. I'm not going to answer that question. I'm going to use this as an occasion to glorify God. That's his response. May I say to you that the way we regard AIDS in today's society is exactly the way in which they treated lepers in Jesus' day. That lepers were the outcast. The disease was seen to be created by sin. And these were people who had to walk around ringing a bell saying, unclean, unclean, unclean. It couldn't be a more perfect parallel. And if you want to know what the Christian attitude should be towards AIDS people, just go to the New Testament and analyze Jesus' attitudes towards people with leprosy. And he didn't go around condemning them. And if Jesus didn't condemn the lepers in his day and play a pious role, then God help the preacher who preaches this kind of crap. Because that's what it is. I mean, nothing upsets me more than evil from the pulpit. And I hear a lot of evil from the pulpit. I mean, most homosexuals I know are so full of self-loathing and contempt and sorrow and pain. Most of I know are so suicidal, and then to get AIDS on top of that. So here he is, this guy with AIDS. He hates himself, he loathes himself, and then on top of all of that, you got a pious preacher who, if the truth were known about him, would probably be run out of the pulpit. I had to speak at a ministerial meeting just after the Jim Baker scandal. You remember Jim Baker, Jimmy Swaggart? And this pious guy got up and said, we must do something to distance ourselves from Jim Baker. And I was to be the speaker, and he went on, and what are we going to do? When I got up, I said, I'm sorry. The time to distance ourselves from Jim Baker was when he was on coast-to-coast television saying stupid stuff. He's a fallen brother now. This is no time to distance ourselves. We need to embrace him and call him a brother. And when people point to him and say, he calls himself a Christian, we ought to be standing up and saying, I'm just like him. Because the only difference between Jim Baker and the rest of us is that they haven't found out about the rest of us. Please, don't give me this junk. If all the secrets of your life were dug out, you wouldn't look any better than Jim Baker. If all the sexual stuff in your life was suddenly exposed, and I'm saying, barring no one here, if it was all known, and I don't care how young you are, how old you are, if it was all known, you'd be shamed up the wall. When people who are as disgusting as I am go around making condemning statements for people who are suffering more than I am suffering, I find the whole thing even more despicable. Have I said enough on that? Have I made myself clear? Yeah. So if your preacher preaches that, you tell him Tony Campolo just thinks you're trash. An ad. And furthermore, he contends you're a disgrace to the gospel. Because the word gospel means what? Do you know what the word gospel means? Good news. That doesn't sound like gospel when you come with bad news to the homosexual. We're 4 minutes over time. This kid already picked up his books. There are guys like me, you in my class. I flunk them. I keep my eyes open for the ones who say, when's this thing going to be over? I got to put my books on my back and get out of here. But you probably have a hot date that's waiting for you right outside. And the lust of the flesh is overtaking you. Can't you see him? Girls, look at... What's your name? What?
Donald.
Donald, look at Donald. This is what you have to defend yourself against for the rest of your life. God bless you and keep you. And may He make you pure. Because He can. He can make you pure. And holy. And good. And loving. And happy.